Welcome to another episode of The Impolite Psychologist. So today I wanted to talk about our bodies and what we do with our bodies, how we express ourselves psychologically through our bodies. Now, doing trauma work with people, one of the questions that I always ask people when they are thinking about a memory from the past is, what is the body sensation that you are feeling when you think about that memory? Now, sometimes memories have body sensations that are clearly associated with them. Like if you broke your arm when you were a kid and you think about that moment, you might kind of feel it in your arm. Now, the other thing that happens when people think of memories and they have a body sensation, sometimes it's sort of a re-experience of some tension in some area of the body. Like I was getting in trouble at school and I feel neck tension when I think about that because I was really nervous and that's where I was holding my tension at that time. And sometimes people feel some kind of body sensation like they want to get sick because the memory is awful. There are a lot of different ways that body sensations show up. Now, that's sort of the traumatic version of it, but even good memories have good body sensations associated with them. Like if you had a really wonderful memory from childhood and you have a smile on your face that you can't forget, or the time that you were eating ice cream and you dropped it on your leg and you might remember feeling that cold sensation on your leg. There are lots of good memories also associated with body sensations. Now, when people get tattoos, that is sort of an interesting thing in and of itself. And certainly across time, tattoos have meant different things to different people. But what I'm specifically talking about is how American culture views tattoos today. Now, certainly more people are getting tattoos today than, say, 30 years ago or 50 years ago. It's much more common nowadays for people to have tattoos. And I often ask people, I do have a lot of people who show up in my practice who are tattooed, and I ask them about what they have on their body and why they have it there and what it means to them. And for some people, it might be some favorite of theirs, a favorite character or favorite family member or favorite lyrics to a song or something like that. And I see people maybe getting tattoos as an act of independence away from their family. Like the first time they moved away, they got a tattoo because they were 18 years old and their parents couldn't say anything about it. So that was it. They decided on their body from then on and everything else in their life. Or an act of rebellion or freedom, if you will. Like I got a tattoo when I quit my job, or I got a tattoo when I broke up with that partner. My also independence, freedom, rebellion, what have you. Sometimes people need to get tattoos just to be the one who decides what happens to their body. This happens to people sometimes when they have been sexually abused. They want to be the ones to decide what happens to their body from now on, and getting a tattoo is them making a decision to do that. Now, I don't know if this is a correlation or not, but it seems to me like when people place tattoos on their face, and I'm not talking about gang members putting tattoos on their face to signify acts of violence in their gang. I'm talking about when people get pictures on their face or words on their face. This I have seen many times is something that people who suffer from psychosis do. And I can't say why that is, but I know it's a step too far for most people that once you start tattooing your face, you have to be in a certain state of mind in order to carry something like that out. And unfortunately, I've heard it has happened to many people who were agitated in the middle of a psychotic process. So I hope that's not true for all facial tattoos, but I have seen it quite often. So another thing, there's a condition known as body dysmorphia, and it's often used synonymously with eating disorders, like, oh, that person is body dysmorphic, they have an eating disorder. But body dysmorphia can exist on its own, like someone who becomes obsessed with, say, a birthmark that they have, some small birthmark on their body. And it becomes an issue like, oh my gosh, this is horrifying. Everyone can see it. I don't look like a normal person. It's out of control and it's absolutely tiny. But the person becomes sort of obsessed with how it's ruining their body in some way and how everyone can notice it because it's so incredibly horrible. So it doesn't have to be necessarily an eating disorder. It's just the idea that something is so horrible on a person's body, they can't get their mind off of it. And it's really their interpretation of it is way different than the rest of the world. The rest of the world doesn't see what they're seeing. Now, I remember being a kid and it's so weird, and seeing this movie, and I had to look it up because all I remember is the movie was about anorexia. And I remember that Jennifer Jason Leigh was in that movie. And I remember one scene in which they showed her body half naked from the back, and it was horrifying just how skinny she was. And I don't remember anything else about that movie. I had to look it up. I noticed it was 1981 when it came out, and so I was fairly young when I saw it. But I remember being just shocked at how skinny a person could become. And I remember having trouble not really understanding why a person would want to do that to themselves. The name of the movie, by the way, was The Best Little Girl in the World. And I have since become a psychologist and tried to understand anorexia in more depth. Now, as a rule, if somebody comes to me and says, I need therapy, I suffer from an eating disorder, I immediately ask them how bad it is in terms of their weight, because I will not work with somebody who is medically at risk. I don't intend on asking anybody about how much they ate today or how much they weigh today. That is just not something I am going to sign up for. And it's really not something that works in therapy if the therapist becomes the police about someone's weight. So if people are normal weight and the eating disorder is sort of like a dormant issue or something they used to struggle with, okay, fine. I'll take them and talk about it. Because what I also do understand is I understand that that has to do with control. And again, it's about making decisions about your body and what you're going to ingest and how far you can take it. Now, of course, the body dysmorphia piece is part of this because people who suffer from anorexia will look in the mirror and think they look worse than most people think they look. And they do begin to view things in a distorted way. But it is about control. What's interesting about it, too, is that it is often associated with people who are upper class. There is something about when you don't have to worry about where your food is coming from or if you're going to eat, it's sort of a luxury to decide not to eat. And so, strangely enough, it does occur more often in upper class people. Now, the other end of the spectrum is obesity. And people who overeat are doing so for different reasons. A lot of times it's because food becomes comfort, and that is something that people can't stop. We can all relate to the types of food that just make us feel warm and fuzzy and good and are just delicious. And we can all relate to that. And what happens is that when a person is distressed psychologically and food becomes that comfort, food becomes emotional support. And whenever a person feels distressed, the food really just provides so much relief. Now, another thing about obesity is sometimes people become overweight on purpose because they were sexually abused as children. And that becomes a way of fending off predators, present and future. That if the person looks undesirable, perhaps no one will bother them sexually. And this is sometimes also what people with anorexia are dealing with. Sometimes people who have anorexia will starve themselves, particularly women, so that they don't look like sexual beings anymore, that they don't have anything that resembles womanhood anymore. They are flat. They are not curvy. And this is sometimes an attempt also to fend off predators. And I've met strippers a lot. And what I have to say about that is I have often asked them what got them to strip. I think a lot of times there's sort of this idealized version of this. I've heard men say, oh, you know, she is a highly sexual person and she needed to put herself through law school or graduate school or medical school, and that was the quickest way to make money, and she was hot, and so she did it, and that was that. That's the nice version of stripping. The not-so-nice version of stripping is the one that I would hear about, because people who are having mental health problems and are also strippers, that's often not a coincidence. And I have asked that question, right? What helped you to decide to be a stripper? And of course, the money is definitely reinforcement for keeping it going, but a lot of times it's that same kind of story that has to do with having control over one's body. I get to decide when I take my clothes off and with whom I take my clothes off. No one else gets to decide that, just me. And a lot of times strippers do so because they can take control of their bodies this way. And no one else is deciding for them. And they're getting paid tremendous amounts of money. And there's all kinds of other stuff that goes along with that, including drug use often as well, but I don't need to get into that today. Now, on a lighter note, something I have noticed about people is what they do with their hair. One of the things I saw would happen when I worked in residential treatment is there would come a time where I would show up to work and suddenly one of my clients would have some drastic haircut where one day they decided to just shave it all off or cut it or dye it one color or go back to a normal color, something like that. And usually, what I noticed was that a change in attitude would often coincide with the hair change. And it usually was in the direction of deciding to be more healthy in general, psychologically, and looking towards a future and having hope for the future. The hair often went with that. And so that was very promising, a very easy, concrete way of measuring where someone was at emotionally. Now, recently, we all experienced the wonderful pandemic, and for women, this became a question of, well, if I don't have access to my hairstylist, do I try to dye my hair at home or do I just let it go? And many women decided during COVID that they would just go gray and see what happens. And I think for a lot of women, making that choice was really empowering. And when more people were doing it, it felt like it wasn't so wrong after all. Do we really need to keep dyeing our hair? Or can we all just kind of go gray? Well, I'm not one of those people to jump into the camp of staying with the gray. I'm going to fight this aging thing as long as I can. Now, that's what's kind of interesting about middle age. Middle age is really that time in life where people come to a crossroads and they decide. And I've talked about this before. We all get to this place where we're looking at the second half of our lives. And mainly, we start to look at that because we are watching our parents at middle age become elderly and die. And we watch that happen. And once that process really begins to happen, and you might have noticed this with an older relative or a parent where you notice them getting older over time, but one thing just sort of happened where one day you saw them again and they were really old. Maybe it was an illness, maybe they lost mobility, maybe they lost their ability to remember, maybe they stopped caring for their body in some way, but you noticed they got old. And once that happens, those of us in middle age start to think about our own bodies getting old, and eventually we will die too. And when we start to think about our own mortality, we start making different choices with our bodies, or sometimes we choose to ignore it, but we think about it. We all think about it. And I often see people in therapy talking about this. Man, I'm 50 years old and I got this beer belly and I'm out of shape and I got to get back in shape. I can't do this anymore. And people will often begin the process of really doing whatever they can to maintain their bodies the best way they can until the end of their life. Now, other people, and I probably don't see these other people as often because people who'd come to therapy want things to be better. The other people are the people who get to midlife and kind of double down on all the bad habits and don't deal with their aging body and instead spend less time going for checkups at the doctor, more time eating bad stuff, maybe less time being concerned what other people think, ignoring feelings in the body that aren't right, just generally neglecting their bodies. And waiting for the end, in my opinion, hoping that the end just comes. And often people who choose to ignore all of the problems that begin in the body, starting in midlife, they ignore that because they also feel a hopelessness about it. Like, well, I'm going to die anyway. Why should I trouble myself with changing my diet? That's just going to make me unhappy, so I'm not going to bother. And it's really sort of a helplessness, a sense that there's only so much you can do, but you're just going to get old and die anyway, so why try? And it's really quite sad because I think ultimately people in this position are waiting for their bodies to just give out and for the whole thing to be over. You know, I think a lot of times what is not thought about is that if you don't try to prevent health problems at midlife, it's very possible that you could have actually a very long and painful death. And who wants to do that? So our bodies are manifestations of our psychology all over the place. And what's going on with somebody can often be seen in their bodies. In fact, there's a book by Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score. He observed in his time working in a mental hospital back in the old, I think it was the 70s, back in the 70s or the 80s, that they would often have basketball games between staff and patients at the mental hospital. And he observed that the way that the patients moved their bodies was very different than the staff. It was much more rigid or robotic, or they had difficulties in some way. And he believes, and he wrote an entire book on trauma showing in the body and how the body really does keep the score about what's going on with you psychologically. And so I would advise you to pay attention to what's going on with you, what's going on inside of your body, any body sensations you have, any feelings that aren't quite right that maybe need to be examined, any thoughts you have about doing something with your body, with your hair, with getting tattoos, anything like that. Think about what it's about. Think about what it means to you. Think about what your body means to you. How you view your body. Do you view it and have shame, or do you look at your body and feel proud? What does that mean? In any case, this is just another place where you can assess how you're doing psychologically. Be well, and thank you for listening.